Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello and welcome to episode 240 of the Washed Up Emo podcast. I am Tom Mullen from washedupemo.com. Today on the podcast, we welcome Christine Osazua. She's originally from Baltimore. She got her start in music at 15 and, of course, started in punk and DIY. She holds degrees in music, marketing, and data science and combined all those passions into doing stuff at Universal, Warner, and she's now the chief strategy officer at Shubes. And also, she sits on the board at Live Association Indian Venue Week and Key Change US. She's also, which I love, a founder of an amazing music conference called Measure of Music, part conference, part hackathon, which introduces music and data to others while highlighting majority-minority attendees and speakers. What's also amazing is probably during COVID, you saw, if you were on LinkedIn at all, and in the music industry, you might have seen her updates posting jobs because there was so little communication in person. And so it was this amazing opportunity. And I think where I first saw her name and also where I started to learn about what she was up to. And so I'm really excited for everyone to hear our story. We talk about punk rock and her life, and it's really, really rad. I hope you guys enjoy it. So once again, this is episode 240 of the Washed Up Emo podcast with Christine Osazua.
It was incredible to be in Baltimore. I always tell people, I love Baltimore. I grew up there. It's one of my favorite places in the world. I've traveled a lot since then, but it's still home. It still feels like home. And that's because growing up, it was like that. You know, if a friend's band was doing a tour, they were going to do, you know, Philadelphia, Baltimore, New York, maybe they'd go down to Richmond. Sometimes they'd squeeze in a Delaware show. You know, they'd squeeze in a, you know, South Jersey show. I could go to a gig every night for a week straight. When I was at university, like when I was in college, I would go to shows in the evening, and then no matter where that was, maybe it was like 2 hours, 3 hours away, and then I would drive back to campus so I can go to class the next day, and then I would leave again to go to the next show. And that was just a consistent occurrence. I always joke that I had smartphones really early on, because I was between sets at gigs, I was literally like writing out like paper outlines and writing out like my research papers and stuff like that, like as I was just kind of like typing, like as I was just staying there between gigs, because I was like, I have to go to the show, but I also have to finish this paper. And that was what growing up was like on the mid-Atlantic, as opposed to like, you know, the rest of the country where like everything is so spaced out. I think I went to like 100+ shows when I was like 18, 19, 17, that age range especially. I am grateful that shortly after I started going to shows, they got rid of smoking in venues.
Yes.
Oh God, thank God. First, my parents hated it.
Dude, the sweatshirts. I had like clothes specifically for shows. No, yeah, like it was like, here's the pants for the show, right? That just stunk.
Exactly. So grateful that that was like 05-ish, I think, is when they got rid of smoking in Baltimore, at least. And I was so grateful. So like, that's one of like a very distinct memory in my head. But to answer your actual question, so like the first time I ever went to a show, I guess the second time I went to a show on my own, and it was like a club show, I met a local band outside. So I was at a Simple Plan show. It was like Plain White Tee, Simple Plan, I think May in Jersey. And I was at the show, left the show, waiting for my parents to come pick me up because I was like maybe 14, 15-ish. And there was a vocal band outside of the theater. They're like, hey, our band's coming. We're playing here. You should come check it out, et cetera, et cetera. So I grabbed the flyer, checked out the band, loved it. And then long story short, I ended up running their street team. And that was like 15-ish basically when I started. So I always kind of had this like kind of, I guess, built-in purpose because I started doing other band marketing. I started doing digital marketing. This was like the era of MySpace, obviously. So I got like into digital marketing through MySpace, through LiveJournal, stuff like that. And so I always had like this going on. So as I was getting older, I ended up like, I started a local magazine, so a print magazine, like a zine basically, in like 06 basically. And it was print. And so I started interviewing bands from like age 16 on. And so that the reason why I'm typing my papers in the middle of concerts is because my undergrad degree was in music business. And so I did music business and journalism, actually. So I was going to gigs, writing papers, writing my actual magazine, all entwined together. So it all had a purpose and all had a meaning that I oftentimes had to explain to my parents. But I was always kind of doing something because I kind of knew really, really early on I wanted this to be my career. And so I was always trying to figure out how to make that happen, even in a market like Baltimore, where the music industry was not a thing. There was no career for the music industry in Baltimore, but that was always like my goal still.
What about that genre? What about, you know, punk, hardcore, emo, all those kind of things? What about it? I mean, definitely, I will say it was hugely popular, right? It was like massive at that time. But what about it that did you kind of connect with? Because it did, the reason why it was huge, right? I mean, it connected with so many people.
Yeah, definitely. And like, yeah, like first of all, like you're saying, like Baltimore is the same. There was a great music scene, but there was no industry. And so one of the things I always said was kind of like a superpower about living in Baltimore was that like, I had the access because no one had any press to do in Baltimore.
1,000%. Same thing in North Carolina and Vermont. No, right. There's no one doing press. Yeah. No. Tickets are fine.
Exactly. Yeah, it was so easy. So I always got the guest on the spot. I always got the interview. I always got, because they're like, who do they know in Baltimore? And so I made some amazing friends just because of that. Like if I had grown up in New York City, I think it would have been an entirely different situation. But that was very special to be in Baltimore. And so I love that. And so I totally feel you when you're talking about like Vermont and you're like, yeah, who's here? Who's coming to Burlington? I'm sure they'll talk to me.
Yeah.
But like how I fell in love, like I fell in love with pop punk when I was young, but I always loved it. You know, I think my first tape was Green Day's Dookie,
which is celebrating its 30th anniversary like this week, right?
Which makes me feel 1 million years old. Yes.
My apologies, Christine.
It's all right. So I think that was like my first tape ever. I've always loved, so even now, so I work at two major labels in the past, and I worked with Atlantic. I did all this stuff, right? And one thing that I always say is that like I have this like special advantage because I love pop music. When people ask me what type of music I listen to, I say pop music. And when I say pop, I mean pop in the most like wide reaching space of what that means, right?
Yes.
I mean like really commercially friendly sounding music, not necessarily the most popular music, but I like, give me the poppiest, like is stuck in your ear version of something. And that is my favorite version of that thing, basically. And I say like, you know, I grew up loving Drake, for example. I love Burna Boy, for example. Fall Out Boy is still my favorite band after all these years. Like, mm-hmm. I love what a pop song sounds like. And taking that 100 steps back to like even very, very small bands, I love what a pop song sounds like. You know what I mean? And so the first show I ever booked myself was my 16th birthday party, and the headliners were All Time Low, because they're from Baltimore, where I'm from. Mm-hmm. But you can see even back then, I love pop music, you know? Like, and so for me, the first time, you know, I think the first time I heard Green Day, the first time I heard Blink-182, I was obsessed. I was like, cool, I want to find 100 more versions of what this sounds like, basically. And that's the rabbit hole I went down for decades. It just kind of shaped who I was. And like, and then the thing about it is, yes, I love the sound, I love the music, but there was also the scene, right? Especially back then, there was MySpace, there was LiveJournal, there was all this stuff all online. And then we had tons of local shows. We had church shows. We had club shows. We had all the stuff in Baltimore as well. And so I made all my friends. If you look at the bridesmaids for my wedding, 4 out of 5 of them I met at a show.
Hell yes.
Most people met their friends in college. I did not. I met them all like growing up, and these are like my best friends, and we all have the same stories to tell, and we all have the same tours we went, we like went to 5 dates of, and we all have these like shared experiences. And so like, these are my memories, and it's so crazy to think that like, we always joke when we find hidden emo kids, no matter where we are within the music industry, and we all have these like shared experiences that I feel like it's just not replicated in the same way as it used to. It felt magical to me from the first show to, now it still feels so magical to me.
Yeah, I think you saying finding people, I feel like there could be hardcore or I think emo, that's, that era and others where, people would come into my office and see like a photo of Minor Threat and they don't have to say anything, right? They just like, oh, mm-hmm. I got you. Or, you might mm-hmm. see a Deftones poster. You might see like a Blink poster and you can kind of relax, right? You can be like, okay. Mm-hmm. And I feel...
These are my people.
Yeah, these are my people. And I think that'll happen, right? For someone that might have a Kiss poster or a Led Zeppelin thing. But I think it's different when it has that a little bit of a like punk side to it where mm-hmm. you mm-hmm. built something. And I say a lot in this podcast, DIY, right? Like you kind of did this thing, saw this advantage and did it. And you took that into doing something for yourself, but also the community. And then it led to your job. And I feel like a lot of people, when they were leaving college or even leaving high school, they're like, oh, like, I don't really know if I did anything or whatever. And like, I remember like having like too many things to write down, right? From mm-hmm. doing zines or doing like putting on shows or like it kind of thrusted you into not adulthood, but like understanding what you had to do to make it. And you wanted to do it. It wasn't like forced.
Oh yes, that's exactly it. This is all like it's all I wanted to do. It's what like I can't even describe. Like so, I started running street teams and like mm-hmm. I started working with different labels. Like all I wanted to do with was this, right? Like it was when I finished school, I think I had a job lined up. Like before, I think 6 months before I graduated from school, I had a full-time job lined up. Like I already had all the experience, and
exactly.
I always joked that I was under 18 years old signing contracts. And I was like, this is not in any way legally binding, but sure.
That's awesome.
But I had a great time doing it, and like I learned so much, there's no other way to learn. And so like even to this day when I'm talking to kids, like kids reach out to me all the time, and like the age who I refer to as kids keeps rising, but they reach out to me all the time and they're like, hey Christine, I really want to work in the music industry, I really want to work in the music industry. And I always say the best and worst thing about the music industry is that anybody can work in the music industry. So if you want to work in the music industry, you just have to do that. There's no one's going to open up the door and say, okay, now you're allowed to be in the music industry. There's that's not how this industry works. If you want to do it, you just kind of have to do it. And that can be challenging to some people that aren't that find discomfort in that like DIY add to that discomfort and just like figure that shit out. But for other people, I think those are people that really, really thrive in terms of like, oh, I don't need any permission. Cool. I'm just going to go ahead and do it until someone tells me no.
100%. Fuck the system. I think discomfort is a great word because it is. Yeah. It's scary to go and do these things or do it the first time that is the discomfort. And also, I don't know if you get bored easily. I do. So like, if I do something and I do it, I want to do something else or I want to try another way of doing it. It's almost like recrafting a song again. Like you might've put that show on, right? And then the next show you're like, let's do this differently. Let's do this at the door. Let's put the merch here. Like, you know what I mean? You're like constantly not fixing, but you're constantly like figuring out what to do.
Iterating.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. That's so like one thing that I find really interesting is so I'm also really techie and nerdy as well. So I have my master's in data science, and I love that space. And like when I tell people that I grew up booking pop punk shows and I have a master's in data science, there's a lot of follow up questions. But really, I think there's that same ethos that runs through it, that iteration, because how data science works essentially is you just have a hypothesis, you have a theory, you're testing it constantly to see what works, see what doesn't work. And then you're you're usually piecing things together, making kind of like an MVP, like minimal viable product, like what works. And then you're going to take that and then make it like and expand upon it. And that's how I found like my entire life has been like that. So there was no kind of difference to it, you know, where I'm like, cool, I need to try this out. I need to see if it works. I want to try something new. How do I make it bigger? How do I make it grow? And so when I'm talking with artists about like artist development, I always talk about treating artists like a startup. Because I love tech, I have a tech background, but this idea of like, how do you build your team? How do you iterate? How do you grow? How do you test what's something new? How do you talk with your fans to get their opinions, to get their input, because they're your customers? All these different things that I feel like I really just learned from like when I was really, like when I was a kid, where I was like, cool, I'm going to try this out. Does this work? I'm going to try this out. Does this work? I'm going to try this out. Does this work? In perpetuity, has this guy kind of gotten me to where I am today in my career and like helping other people out?
I think that resonates a little close to home too for me, because the other way I like to think about it is I pretend each artist I'm working with is my favorite band. Like I pretend that it's like X band and I'm treating that like that. And I think sometimes it's not that you don't like their music. It's just, you're trying to find that core, right? You're trying to find that inner like love. Like you said, you need to iterate. You need to explain to like, how do they talk to their fans? How does that artist talk to their fan? What would I want if I was their biggest fan? And you're almost like, you know, put, and I feel sometimes when I was working with a lot of people or artists, like it just felt like a lot of people talking to them had this one way of doing things. They liked it. They were comfortable and they just wanted to do that over and over again. And it's harder to do the route that we're talking about. It's harder to kind of break it down. And that's what, you know, like you talked about with data science, you are literally taking these things bit by bit.
Exactly. And that's the saddest thing I see is when you see an artist and they're working with a team or a label, and the label obviously has no idea what to do with them, because that artist does not sound like the other 10 artists they have on their roster or whatever it might be. And you're like, oh, there's all this potential. Like there's so much missed potential in the weird. There's so much missed potential in the different, like just because someone doesn't understand it doesn't mean there's not something really special there. And that's, I think that's something that came something I discovered so much growing up in like pop punk, is that like, there were so many different bands, and everyone, I'm sure from the outside, were like, oh, those bands all sound the same. And I mean, obviously there was a lot of overlap, but there were so many different bands that kind of like fell into the scene that didn't sound like everybody else, that still thrived because it was much more about, like, as the kids would say now, it's much more about the vibe. It's more about the energy. It's more about like what that sound is. And like, I think if you were to kind of like look back as like what happened back then, you would see like there were certain bands where it was clear they got signed to like a huge massive label and they got a huge deal, and they're like, cool, you're going to go ahead and be the next blank. And that band was not going to be the next blank, but they didn't know what to do with it, you know, as opposed to really, like you're saying, treat that band like they're a favorite band. Like, what is it really? Who's that audience? What do they love? What do they want? What do they want to sell? Like, who they want them to tour with? I will flag, like I mentioned, the first show I ever went to, my club show I went to was like Simple Plan, Plain White Tees, and I want to say it was May in Jersey. And one of the reasons why I distinctly remember this lineup is because May was put on this show, and let me tell you what kids did not want to hear that came to see Simple Plan. It was May. It was the most, I felt so bad for the band, because by the end of the show, I think kids were like literally just talking over them, because that was not just because the band looked a certain way and, you know, just because they were like, they were from a certain area and things like that. I'm sure whoever booked it was like, cool, let's toss them on this tour as well. And it just, at least in that market I was in, that did not work. And you can see when this is the case. You can see when like someone presumed they knew what to do, or they just presumed they understood the audience, all this stuff, without actually really thinking about it. A, things were going so quick.
Yes.
For example, that Simple Plan show was after I Do Anything came out, but it went on sale before I Do Anything came out.
Oh.
But they performed after I Do Anything came out. So let me tell you, it was chaos.
Right.
At the size of the band, the band became so big so quickly that they could have played a much bigger room than the room they were in.
Oh,
too.
So it's crazy.
Like, it was just so many things happening all at once. I still remember, distinctly remember this. Like, it's been, I don't even know how many years now. It's been almost 20 years. I remember all, like, I remember this evening so clearly because all of these different factors that were all playing on top of each other, essentially. But that's exactly it, what you're saying in terms of, like, they weren't as open. But that's, like, that's something that's it's someone's job to figure out, right? Like, it's someone's job to figure out, hey,
yes,
these kids that came to see Simple Plan, what is the thing? And I'm not saying that people have to, like, you need to completely, like, take people out of their, like, boundary, but you're able to stretch people's boundaries to some extent, but you have to really understand what that means, because if it had been Motion City soundtrack on that show, I think those kids would have been just as receptive.
Yes.
But, and that is not, that's not the same vibe as Simple Plan, but it's a different sound. You know what I mean? Like, it just, there's those, that's a nuance I think sometimes people don't get. And that's why when you were saying, like, you have to treat every band like they're your favorite band when you're working with them, that's the exact reason, is because you need to figure out that. It's easy to figure out, hey, obviously put all these bands that, you know, are from the Mid-Atlantic on this bill together. Like, that's easy to, you know, figure out. But really figure out what that magic sauce is meant to be, I think it's much more challenging if you're not in it every single day trying to figure it out, you know?
And that thing, I think it goes back to anybody listening that's in a band or playing music, is who is your team? And this is not just a major label story. They were, you know, bands would come at the indie label and just think, oh, I'm going to be the next Circus Survive, or I'm going to be the next, you know, Armor for Sleep. And that's not what you should be. You should be your band. And I think sometimes they relaxed. They were kind of like, oh, I'm on this label now. And who's your team? Are you calling? Are you figuring out who does what? Are you and this is really the weeds part. Like, it's hard to be like, there might be someone at that label that really doesn't do it, but you need to call them twice a week. You need to learn that. You need to understand, like, advocating for yourself and asking and knowing what to ask for. And I feel that's across the board. I think the major labels get somewhat of a bad rap because of the, a lot, probably more in the press and more things, but it happens at the indie labels a lot. And it's almost like, that's almost more where you need to cut your teeth. And so I think you're giving that example of like, yeah, that band blew up, and like, I'm sure the people on the Simple Plan team, like, they found out, right? They probably found out the next day. They're like, dude, this show oversold. We need to play the biggest venue. What are we going to do for the rest of the tour? They probably, they maybe reacted, but they were quick.
I completely agree with you when it comes to, like, advocating for yourself as an artist. I think sometimes, like, the thing about it, though, and, like, I have all of the sympathy in the world for artists, despite me making jokes about very difficult ones often, I have all the sympathy in the world, because I say this as simply as possible. So my MBA is in marketing, and then I did my master's in data science, right? So I'm really good at numbers. I'm really good at marketing, streaming, et cetera, et cetera. I'm really bad at other things. And so I'm really good at marketing for an artist. However, I cannot write a song. I have no means or understanding or knowledge on how to write a song. However, artists are told they have to not only create the music, but then they have to be content creators, and they have to be influencers, and they have to do their marketing, and they have to understand their business, and they have to understand their finance. They have to understand all of these bits, A, to make sure they're not getting screwed over by anybody constantly, and B, so that they can advocate for themselves properly. So they have to do all these education pieces on top of creating the music. And that's so tough. And I recognize that's so tough, because even if I'm wearing two or three hats for a project, an artist is still wearing all of those hats.
Right.
And I think there's no blueprint. There's no paint. There's no book. There, I mean, there's books to read, obviously, but there's no, like, there's no guide. In the same way, anyone can be a, you know, a music exec. Anyone can be an artist. And, like, how do you get the foundation you need to know what you need to do is always something that I think will be a constant struggle for artists, no matter how big or how small they are.
Very well said. That brings into... explain, I know there's a lot of stuff that you've done over the years, and I mean, we already dated ourselves. I've already outed you on the date of the show. Everyone's doing the math. They already know I'm old. So what about you know, doing a little bit more within the industry and kind of stepping away from, you know, labels and kind of working for yourself? What was that like? And I know you kind of do both. I didn't mean to say you've stepped away, but, like, you know what I mean? You've kind of, like, branched out.
Yeah, definitely. So it's been a journey. It's been the craziest, like, I don't know, craziest 10 years at this point, I would say. So I worked at two major labels. I did that for 5+ years full time. I did it part time while I was in college as well for a bit. And I learned so much. I got to do so much. I got to experience so much. And I really, really loved what I was doing. But the thing about that is that there's only at a certain point, like you were talking about before, I don't want to say I got bored, because there was always something interesting or new happening. But at some point, you feel like, I want to try something new. You know, I want to do something different. And, like, just popping over to the next major label wasn't enough different. Even going to an indie, like a big indie label, it just wasn't enough different. I wanted to make sure I was, like, experiencing everything, trying new things, doing new things. And so that's how I ended up popping over to the live space. So I was obviously, like I mentioned, I was in the live space years and years and years ago when I was still in college. And that was my first job out of school, was in live as well. And so I really wanted to kind of pop back into that space. So that's what I'm doing full time now. I'm at a ticketing startup. We do event marketing, event ticketing. And so that's like my full time job. And then during COVID, especially, I started doing a bunch of side stuff, the biggest being my conference. So I run this conference called Measure of Music. It's a music tech and data conference and hackathon that happens every year. And I started doing that because basically during COVID, everybody lost their jobs except for people at major labels, essentially. Like, there was mass layoffs that everyone saw all over the place. And so a lot of people were reaching out. They're like, hey, Christine, I need some help. I need some advice. I need some, you know, guidance here. And so I was talking with people constantly. Every week I was having one-on-one chats with different people about their experience helping them out. And I was like, cool, how do I scale this? How do I help more people out? And so I came up with the idea of Measure of Music. And that the big component of it was the hackathon, because it gave people a portfolio item to add to their resume. So despite whatever part of the industry they were in, or if they're not in the industry, they would have a means to get into the industry, basically, or at least something to show for that. And so it's been a lot of different things, a lot of different stuff sorting things out. But really, one thing I really wanted to make sure I did, especially after I left major labels, I never wanted to be defined by my job. I always wanted to be defined by myself. And that's something that's always really, really important to me. And if you're at a massive company, unless you are very, very, very senior at that massive company, you become your company, not yourself. And that's incredibly important to me.
I agree. I think working at an indie early on and doing a lot of different things, when I got into the major label, I remember in my first marketing meeting, and they go around and do all the updates, right? You've been in those meetings.
Yes.
And I started realizing, whoa, I recognize what he said there. Obviously not the whole thing, or they mm-hmm. said. And I started to realize, like, okay, whoa, I think me doing 12 things for this label previously is going to help me. Like, I instantly was like, oh my God, I know what that guy said. Like, instead of like only knowing PR, right? Or only knowing yep. radio. Like, I was like, I kind of know what the international guy just said. Uh-oh. Right. Mm-hmm. Like, I think I can help. Or I think for a band or even them understanding those things. But also as a someone trying to get in the industry, like you said, showing up and at this conference, you're going to be meeting so many different people. And as a starting out, you need to do something else. You can't just have that be your thing.
Yes, definitely. I you know, I've talked to so many people, even ones that are still at major label and things like that. And they're like, oh, Christine, I want to do something new. I'm doing something else. They're like, but I don't have any other skill set. And that deeply depresses me. And that's so sad to hear. I mean, obviously they do have other skills that they're not thinking about at the time, but the problem with being at really large companies, and this is no slight to major labels, this I'm sure is very similar to no matter what type of large company you are in the industry, is that you end up just doing one thing. So you have all the skills in the world to be a product manager, but you have never got to touch finance. You never got to touch A&R. You never got to touch any of these other parts. And so the only job that seems most valuable for you to get next is just to go from marketing manager at one label to senior marketing manager at the next label, and then do that in perpetuity until you die. And so that sounded so terrifying to me personally. And so it was always really important for me to diversify what I know, diversify what I'm doing. And if I ever felt like I was in a position where I was only doing one thing over and over again, like that wasn't long term for me. And so that's why I moved over to the startup space, because I love startups. I love tech, but I also love, like, being in a startup means you're just doing everything. You're touching everything. You're trying everything. You're figuring everything out. It's a constant, like, iterative process, like I was saying. And I love that space much more than, like, okay, every day, every week, I'm going to do this report. Every week, I'm going to do this thing. Every week, New Music Friday comes out. We have to figure out how our positioning is, et cetera, et cetera. I wanted something bigger than that. And I think a lot of other people are realizing the importance of having something bigger than that for them to work on and be a part of.
I love that. Can you talk about the LinkedIn stuff that you were doing? Or are doing, like, yeah. I think that's really interesting, and another way for people to understand kind of, like, you know, something can grow.
Yeah. So another thing that I started doing during COVID, especially, was I got really active on LinkedIn. I'd always been on LinkedIn because I was an MBA. I have an MBA, and that's like a thing we do. But I just always I like when I was there during COVID, I realized like there was just like a lot of opportunity to talk with people. And so what I started doing on LinkedIn during COVID was I was looking at, I was seeing job postings. So obviously a lot of people were getting laid off, but there were still companies that were hiring. There were still job postings that were happening. And so I was collating all those job postings together and putting them into a, like, just like a list every week of like, here's all the jobs I saw here on LinkedIn. And one thing I was doing specifically is I was only posting jobs where people posted them, not companies, not just whatever you saw as a listing, but when people posted them. And the reason why I did when people posted them is because like, there's a lot of bullshit out of there. There's a lot of like ghost jobs that aren't real. Literally, I don't think a lot of people know that sometimes companies will just post a ton of jobs online so it looks like they're hiring, so it looks better to shareholders and it looks better for their share price, basically. That's only reason, or it looks good to their investors. That is the only reason why they're actually putting job postings up. They're not actually hiring. Things like that happen all the time.
Or they post it because they have to legally and they're hiring someone internally.
That's
the other one.
Or they already have somebody in mind.
But like, they have to post it. Yeah.
Exactly. And so that's exactly it. So there's all these reasons why people will post a job that there's not actually real, but they wouldn't go through the trouble of then, as their own personal self, posting on LinkedIn, hey, I'm hiring, and then having to deal with like,
that's totally true.
You would never do that.
No.
If you weren't going to hire anyone anyway, why would you go to that Twitter, right? You
know? I love that like bullshit meter you just put up.
Right.
That's so good. Tom didn't post it, so it's not real. Yeah, it's totally simple.
Right. Like, if you were hiring for a job, you would post on, like, someone, maybe not you, but somebody would post, hey, I'm hiring for this job. It wouldn't just be on the company page, right? That's crazy.
Oh, my God, that's great. Oh, my God. When you figured that out, I hope you had, like, a celebration or you did some good things. Because that's fucking, like, I figured it out. But
I figured out the code, right?
Yeah, you figured out the code. But I remember seeing that and going, like, okay, well, again, just like you said, I can trust this.
Yeah, that's exactly it. And so like, so that's why I started compiling them. So because I was like, no, I want these to be real jobs, because like, I don't want to be sending people in a direction to look at a new job and it's just a bullshit job anyway. You know, I want these to be real actual jobs. And so that's why I started collating them in the way I have been doing. And I'm still doing that. I'm on week 100 and something at this point. I've gone down to like kind of like bi-weekly, so weekly, but still like, at least 2 or 3 times a month, I'm posting like these job roundups, and you know, I'm posting all the jobs and tagging all the people and things like that. And so many people have reached out and said, hey, I found a job through this. Companies reach out all the time and they're like, oh, Christine, someone saw your job posting. Thanks so much for this. That's, we just hire someone from there and stuff like that, which is super cool. And I'm still doing it because I thought like this was going to be a temporary thing. You know, I was like, oh, cool. You know, this will be a couple of months while people are struggling. And then we've done like, and now we've had like the 8th massive round of layoffs every month, basically, that it still feels very much necessary. But something that I really enjoy doing, because I also get to see what's out there. I get to see what's going on. It helps me understand what's like what the industry, when the industry is going. Like I'll see like different new job titles.
Exactly.
And new companies. I'm like,
exactly.
Oh, that's really cool. That's really interesting. Stuff like that too. So I'm getting value out of it, obviously, as well. But I'm hoping that it's helping other people. And it's like, that's why I started doing it, and like that's why I kind of continue to do it, because like some little things you can do to help other people, right? Like it doesn't take a lot of time for me to do it, but I think it helps and gives back a whole lot.
Absolutely. It helped me. It helped me when I was looking. There were things that I would pop up and be like, oh, I forgot that my friend posted that. Let me go reach out to him, right? There's other ways that it might just be, you know, a reach out. The other thing I wanted to mention is the policy side of your career. Can you expound on that a little bit? I just noted, you know, a lot of stuff that you're advocating for people, and I just wanted, you know, what has that been like?
Oh God, yeah. So that's also something that I got really focused on during COVID. Like I said, it's been a really intense like 5 years. But you cannot physically see me on this podcast, but I am a Black woman, and I also live in London. I am an immigrant here in London, and then I'm also first-generation American, so I am Nigerian. My parents were born in Nigeria. I was born in America. I identify as Nigerian-American, so I always joke that I have a lot of intersectionality. I am just a lot of it all at once, basically. And so I find myself constantly advocating for people that look like me, people that don't look like me. Like it's a lot to do, but I really value it. And so during COVID, I became the ERG lead for my company for the people of color group. So ERG is an employee resource group. So it's just like a community or a collection of employees within the company and allies within the company that was for people of color. So that was a group I was working on. We had other ones for women. We had ones for, the queer population. We had all kinds of different ones. But I became the ERG lead during the height of COVID. I became the ERG lead during the Black Lives Matter movement. It was a really intense and a really like challenging time overall. But we did a lot of good. You know, we did a speaker series. We talked to all the different label heads while I was there about diversity and inclusion. I constantly am kind of working and advocating and being really outspoken about it, partly because I feel like I have the privilege to do so. I've gotten senior enough in my career that I don't mind speaking out when I think something is incorrect or when something is wrong. And I feel like I'm doing that for all the people that aren't senior enough in their career where they feel comfortable doing that. And so when it comes to like myself, my conference, like I mentioned, my conference is the majority minority in gender and race for our speakers, attendees, registrants every single year. And people often ask, how I do that? What did I have to do that? I didn't have to do anything. It's my network and the people I'm around, the people I'm working with, the people that are recommended to me, the people that apply to speak are diverse. And that's on purpose because I want to surround myself with different voices, different ideas, you know, different backgrounds. And that's something that I'm constantly preaching to the music industry as a whole. And it's so easy to just fall back on, oh, I'm going to hire my friend, or I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that. But all of the nepotism and the, you know, cronyism and all of these like things all seem innocent by themselves, but really they're really detrimental in so many ways. And so that's something that I'm constantly trying to like overcome and talk with people about to make sure people realize and see that, you know, the conference they just pieced together has a panel of all white men or all panels of all white men, or trying to make people see that, hey, did you notice that you didn't get any diverse, you know, applicants for this role? Why is that? Where are you posting your jobs? Things along those lines. That's even one of the reasons why I do the jobs roundup, is because oftentimes you'll see people post on LinkedIn, and yes, it's great they're posting on LinkedIn, but it'll just be like, hey, does anyone know a marketing manager for a project I'm working on? And that'll be the whole post. And so if you weren't following that person, you would never have seen that post. You would have never been, you know, a contender for that role.
Right.
And so I like to amplify these roles as well, because that's not a role listed on the jobs board. That's just a role someone say, hey, does anyone know anyone that can recommend someone for this? And that's oftentimes how the music industry works. And if people are so siloed in their own networks, then that never gets amplified. That never gets louder for it to have, you know, more diverse options. And sometimes, not always, but sometimes people are even malicious when it comes to the fact they're not hiring, or they're not, you know, considering, or they're not thinking about, you know, being more open. They just don't notice. They don't see it. It's not even a thought process in their head. They're just going with the easiest person to fill this role as quickly as possible because we are on a deadline. And so if I can help alleviate some of that, that's something I think about constantly. And that's kind of like what I've been working on over the, especially the last 5 years, to make sure that the people get more opportunity. There's just more options out there. And then even what I'm doing with my conference, I also pay my speakers, and very few music conferences pay their speakers. And I believe, especially because my speakers are majority minority in gender and race, that is incredibly important for me to pay them for their time and their voices, because those are also the people that are often the most underpaid when it comes into tech or in the music industry. So if I'm going to say that this is incredibly important, I should figure out a way to make sure that I'm contributing to the solution rather than the problem.
I love that when you talked about saying like, oh, we need to hire this person really quickly, and I know this person, I have to fill it because I have to do that. And you helping advocate, or at least help them understand and get out of their tunnel vision a little bit and be like, look, mm-hmm. over here. And that other half, I think that I really like, is there are different ways that people find out about information. There are different ways that mm-hmm. people access information, right? Sometimes it's mm-hmm. only a cell phone. Sometimes mm-hmm. it's someone's laptop somewhere else. And so it might be the access, and I think being able to, who sees it, there's a huge gap.
Exactly. People live in different worlds all the time, and I don't think they fully realize it until someone points it out. I remember when I went from major label, so I left major label, and I started really getting closer with the indie music here in the UK. So it was a company, well, there's an association called the Association of Independent Musicians, AIM, is what their name is here in the UK. I got invited to their award show. So they had their own award show every year. And I was like hanging out in like the drinks or like the opening reception part of it. And I realized that I knew almost nobody there.
Wow.
And the reason why I knew almost nobody there is because I had worked in major label for almost 6 years. And I'm like, that's crazy. It's the same industry. We're in the same industry. It's not even that different. But because I was on one side of the industry for so long, I knew almost no one on this other side. And that's just like the tiniest little example. Like, imagine how frequently that's playing out consistently throughout everybody's day. And like, that's why people don't hear of opportunity. That's why things aren't more diverse. It's just like the silo we're all in. And the music industry is really, really good at perpetuating silos at all points of time. Because I'll tell you to this day, I still don't understand how publishing works. I've worked recorded for a long time. Don't know how publishing works. And that's just one thing.
That's okay.
I don't understand it.
That's okay. I don't understand. I've never understood geometry, and I will never. And yeah, that's just how it is.
Exactly. We all have our issues. And so I think about that constantly. Like, what is the thing? Where are the gaps? Where are the things that people don't see or understand? And like, how can I help kind of like fill in those gaps? You know, and that happens in a lot of different ways.
One thing I remember hearing, I think it was Barack, and he was just talking about how like politics is not easy and it takes time and patience. And I think a lot of times we don't have patience. We don't have that time, and we don't feel that. And I think from a policy standpoint, you know, when you talk to a friend and they're just trying to fix the problem and all you want them to do is listen. I feel like sometimes policy, and I bring that word up because I really feel that the way that you're advocating and saying these things and reminding people, it's not going to be tomorrow morning we're going to wake up and everything's okay. Like, it's going to be these starts and stops, and it's going to go back a little bit and then it's going to go up. Mm-hmm. And we have to be okay with that, but we can't reserve ourselves to not want to try when you might get one bad day or one bad week. And I just think from your standpoint, what is that energy from that policy standpoint, that it is not always a straight line to top 10 in the Billboard and then you move on? This is not a chart.
Exactly. Yes. I completely agree with everything you're saying. I mean, the thing about it is that like, it's hard. It is not easy. And I'm not a social worker. I don't have a DEI background. I don't have any of those things. And I'm just a person that's trying to figure it out. And it's so hard to be patient. And I feel it when people are frustrated. I feel it when people are upset. I get upset. I get frustrated all of the time, because like, sometimes it's not new information. There's no new or riveting information that I hear. You know, right now in the UK, they're doing, or I guess they've just released the study that have come out about misogyny in the music industry. And the thing about it is, like, I haven't read the whole thing yet, but like, I very highly doubt I'm going to be surprised by any of the things that come out of that study. I think at this point, I understand why people don't feel patient. I understand why people are really frustrated, is because so many things are nothing new. The fact that you don't have any, Black or Latino or women in your boards, in senior leadership at your companies, no one should point that out to you. That should be something that should be obvious to you. And the fact that we still have to constantly do that and talk about it and advocate in this way seems so ridiculous to me, because you would think at some point people would figure it out that this is not okay. I mean, I would say, like, from a bigger standpoint, you can definitely see the wins, though. And like you said, it's not a chart. some of it you can't quantify, which is very frustrating for me because I am a data scientist. You can't quantify everything. I think about growing up, I grew up booking shows when I was like 15 and 16 and 17. And I think about some of the things people said to me, some of the ways people like talked to me, all kinds of stuff when I was young, that like it was just completely normal. People are like, oh yeah, that's how this works. I'm like, you can definitely see now that people understand certain things are not okay anymore. And that's great. Like, I'm not in any way discrediting the progress that we have made, because I think a whole lot of women are much safer than they've ever been in their entire lives working in the music industry than as they are right now. But it's not perfect. We're not anywhere close to being there yet. And that's incredibly frustrating because it feels like it's taking forever. But we're making those wins. And I think when you're doing this work and when you're talking with people, you have to get to the point where like, you recognize those wins, but you also recognize there's still a lot of work to be done. One of my favorite examples of this is there's this pop punk band called Meet Me at the Altar. They're all people of color, queer pop punk band, and they went on tour with All Time Low last year. And let me tell you, as a little Black girl that grew up going to pop punk shows, I would have given anything in the world to see Black girls on stage opening a show or headlining a show, a pop punk show. Like, that is unheard of to me. And they're signed to what was my favorite label growing up, Deal by Ramen. That is like the progress that I see that I hold on to when things feel really bleak, is just that like, hey, this is all possible. This is not impossible to do. We're making the progress. It's just slow sometimes.
That's perfect. Christine, you're amazing. You're great. I know you probably have done a lot of interviews, but you getting to be able to put in pop punk references and have someone not have to go, who, is really probably helpful, right?
Yes, exactly. Explain more about who that is. Yes, yes.
No, we don't have time. I have shit to get done. That was great. Great job.
Thank you. No, great. Like, this was great. I had a great time. I could talk about this stuff all day, and I feel like I was asked questions I don't normally get asked, which is cool. Like, thank you. I really appreciate it.
I've heard it all before from everyone. From the ghosts of Baltimore. If I take the time to walk away, anymore. If I take the time.